Now, give us a moment and we will resume dictation. You may ask questions on that material later. The various levels of consciousness discussed here may appear to be very divorced from ordinary waking ones. The divisions are quite arbitrary. These various stages all represent different attributes and directions inherent within your own soul. Clues and hints of them, shadows and reflections appear even in the consciousness that you know. Even normal waking consciousness, then, is not innocent of all other traces of existence, or devoid of other kinds of awareness. It is only because you usually use your waking consciousness in limited ways that you do not encounter these clues with any regularity. They are always present. Following them can give you some idea of those other directions, and those other levels of which we have spoken. Often, for example, seemingly unrelated symbols or images may rise into your mind. Usually, you ignore them. If instead you acknowledge them and turn your attention to them, you can follow them to several other layers, at least, for example, A1 and A2, with ease.
9:35.
The symbols or images may change as you do so, so that you perceive little similarity between, say, the initial image and the next one. The connection may be highly intuitional, however, associative, and creative. Often a few moments' reflection afterward will allow you to see why the one image merged into the other. A single image may suddenly open up into an entire mental landscape, but you will know none of this if you do not acknowledge the first clues that are just beneath present awareness and almost transparent if you are only willing to look. Alternate focus is merely a state in which you turn your consciousness in other than its habitual direction in order to perceive quite legitimate realities that exist simultaneously with your own. You must alter your perception to perceive any reality that is not geared practically toward material form. This is something like looking out of the corner of your eye or mind rather than straight ahead.
Pause.
Using alternate focus, with practice, it is possible to perceive the different physical formations that have filled any given area of space, or that will fill it in your terms. In some dream states, you may visit a particular location and then perceive the location as it was, say, 3 centuries ago and 5 years hence, and never understand what the dream meant. It seems to you that space can be filled only by a given item at a time, that one must be removed to make room for another. Instead, you only perceive in this fashion. In alternate focus, you can dispense with the root assumptions that usually guard, direct, and limit your perception. You are able to step aside from the moment as you know it, and return to it and find it there. Consciousness only pretends to bow to the idea of time. At other levels, it enjoys playing with such concepts and perceiving great unity from events that occur outside of a time context, mixing, for example, events from various centuries, finding harmony and points of contact by examining both historical and private environments, plucking them out of the time framework. Again, you even do this in your sleep. If you do not do it in the waking state, it is because you have held your consciousness in too tight a rein. Now you may take your break.
9:48. The pace had been fast. Resume at 10:05.
Now, as mentioned somewhat earlier in this book, while your normal waking consciousness seems continual to you, and you are aware usually of no blank spots, nevertheless, it has great fluctuations. To a large extent, it has memory only of itself and its own perceptions. In normal waking consciousness, then, it seems as if there are no real other kinds of consciousness, no other areas or levels. When it encounters blank spots and returns, it blots out awareness that the moment of non-function occurred. It forgets the stumble. It cannot be aware of alternate kinds of consciousness while being itself, unless methods are taken that allow it to recover from this amnesia.
10:13. We had forgotten to put our cat Willie in another room before the session. Now he jumped into Jane's lap, so I had to lay my notebook aside. He purred as I carried him back to the studio. Jane sat waiting patiently in trance.
It plays hopscotch in and out of reality. It is gone sometimes, and you are not aware of it. On such occasions, your attention is focused elsewhere, in what you might call mini-dreams or hallucinations, or associative and intuitive processes of thought that go quite beyond normal focus. In these lapses, you are perceiving other kinds of reality, with other than normal waking consciousness. When you return, you lose the thread. Normal waking consciousness pretends there was never any break. This happens with some regularity, and to varying degrees, from 15 to 50 times an hour, according to your activities. At various times, many people do catch themselves, the experience being so vivid that it leaps the gap, so to speak, with perception so intense that even normal waking consciousness is made aware of it. These intervals are quite necessary to physical consciousness. They are woven through the fabric of your awareness so cleverly and so intimately that they color your psychic and feeling atmosphere. Normal waking consciousness weaves in and out of this infinite supportive webwork. Your inner experience is so intricate that verbally it is almost impossible to describe. Normal waking consciousness, while having memory of itself, obviously does not retain all memory all of the time. It is said that memory of past events drops back into the subconscious. It is still intensely alive, and by alive I mean living and active, although you do not focus upon it. Inner portions of your personality also have memory of all of your dreams. These exist simultaneously and suspended, so to speak, like lights over a dark city, illuminating various portions of the psyche. These memory systems are all interconnected. Now, in the same way, you have your memory of past lives, all quite complete and all operating in the entire memory system.
Pause at 10:23.
In periods of conscious blank spots, or certain fluctuations, these memory systems are often perceived. As a rule, the conscious mind with its own memory system will not accept them. When a personality realizes that such other realities exist and that other experiences with consciousness are possible, then he activates certain potentials within himself. These alter electromagnetic connections, both within the mind, the brain, and even the perceptive mechanisms. They bring together reservoirs of energy and set up pathways of activity, allowing the conscious mind to increase its degree of sensitivity to such data. The conscious mind is set free of itself. To a large measure, it undergoes a metamorphosis, taking on greater functions. It is able to perceive, little by little, some of the content before closed to it. It need no longer perceive the momentary blank spots fearfully, as evidence of non-existence. The fluctuations mentioned earlier are often quite minute, yet highly significant. The conscious mind knows well of its own fluctuating state. When once it is led to face this, it finds not chaos, or worse, non-existence, but the source of its own abilities and strength. The personality then begins to use its own potential. Now you may take your break.
10:35. Even though her trance had been deep, Jane had been aware of her slower delivery. She said this was because Seth wanted her to use just the right words. She had had many images also, which she couldn't verbalize now. She could only say things like, systems of lights for memories, etc. I told her I thought the material was very rich and evocative. Resume at 10:47.
Now, periods of reverie and creative moments of consciousness both represent excellent entryways into these other areas. In the usual creative state of consciousness, the regular waking consciousness is suddenly supported by energy from these other areas. Waking consciousness alone does not give you the creative state. Indeed, normal waking consciousness can be as afraid of creative states as it is of blank states, for it can feel that the I is being thrust aside, can feel the upthrust of energy that it may not understand. It is precisely in the low points of fluctuation that such experiences originate, for normal consciousness is momentarily at a weak state and in a period of rest. The whole physical organism undergoes such normal fluctuations, again, that are usually quite unnoticed. These periods also fluctuate, following rhythms that have to do with the characteristic personality. In some, the waves of motion are comparatively long and slow, the valleys within being sloped. With others, the reverse is true. With some, the lapses are more noticeable, outside of the norm. If the situation is not understood, then the personality may find it difficult to relate to physical events. If he is able to perceive the other areas of consciousness, he may find himself in still more difficulty, not realizing that both systems of reality are valid.
10:55.
The fluctuations also follow seasonal changes. Events from any given layer of consciousness are reflected in all other areas, each being actualized according to the characteristics of the given layer. As one dream is like a stone thrown into the pool of dream consciousness, so any act appears in this pool also in its own guise. Alternate focus allows you to perceive the many manifestations of any given act, the true multidimensional reality of a given thought. It enriches the normal consciousness. You are active in these other layers, whether or not you are aware of it. You learn not only in physical life and in the dream state, but in these interior existences of which you have no memory. Creative abilities of a specific nature, or healing abilities, are often trained in this fashion, only then emerging into physical actuality. Your future thoughts and acts are as real in these dimensions as if they had already occurred, and as much a part of your development. You are formed not only by your past, but by your future, and by alternate existences. These great interactions are only a part of the framework of your soul. You can, therefore, change present reality as you understand it from any of these other layers of consciousness. End of dictation, and very nearly the end of the chapter.
Pause at 11:04. Seth then gave some personal material for Jane, dealing with her writing class and other matters. End at 11:12 p.m. Session 577, March 31st, 1971, 9:13 p.m., Wednesday. This afternoon, Jane held her first creative writing class.
Now, good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
We will begin dictation. Any one of these various layers of consciousness can be used as the normal acting consciousness, reality being viewed from that specific standpoint. Physical reality is therefore glimpsed by other kinds of personalities in other systems from their own unique viewpoint. Peering at it from this angle, so to speak, you would not recognize it as your own home system. From some of these viewpoints, your physical matter has little or no permanency, while to others, your own thoughts have a shape and form perceived by observers, but not by yourselves. In traveling through the states of consciousness, these other personalities would try to attain some focus and perceive your environment, trying to make sense of data with which they are largely unacquainted. Since many of them are unaware of your idea of time, they would find it difficult to understand that you perceive events with intervals between, and would not perceive the inner organization that you thrust upon your normal environment. Yours is obviously a probable system to other fields also touched by the field of probabilities. As these systems are adjacent to yours, so is yours adjacent. Alternate focus allows personalities from other realities to perceive your own then, as it can theoretically at least allow you a glimpse into their existence. End of chapter. And now I have an assignment for you, and the opportunity to participate in my book. You may take the rest of the session to make up an excellent list of questions that will appear in the next question and answer chapter. If you have questions already given by others, by all means include these. But they should be questions from you rather than questions posed by me. They will be more pertinent to the reader. Then present these to me at our next session, or one at a time, or two, as you prefer, and I will answer them. You may organize the questions under headings, but you need not do so. If several happen to fall under one large subject heading, this would simply be a convenient way of handling it.
Can Rupert ask questions too?
You may both make up the list. You need not have the whole list by the next session. One answer may take some time.
Well, that's what I was wondering about.
I suggest, then, that you both get to work.
The telephone began to ring while I was writing. Jane was still in trance, but didn't appear to be bothered. Feeling some irritation, I let it ring until it stopped.
I will be around to inspire you.
9:30 p.m. This had been the shortest session in several years. I was still surprised at the quick ending. I didn't even say good night to Seth. Already, I was wondering whether we should ask questions we thought others were interested in, or just those we spontaneously came up with ourselves. Jane checked the outline Seth had given us for his book in the 510th session for January 19, 1970. Sure enough, he had listed a question and answer chapter. I had forgotten this. For some reason, I felt uneasy now. Perhaps I thought it might not be a good idea to interrupt the flow of the book in such a manner. Jane hadn't read any of Seth's book since the 521st session in Chapter 4. In spite of temptations, she has always felt it better to be free of concern about it. We didn't think her not looking at it would interfere with her having questions. She has, of course, had contacts with the book, aside from her own imperfect memory. I gave her a couple of short passages to read to her ESP class. She discussed the book to some extent with Patty Middleton recently, and I've talked about it at times, although without referring back to the typed page. Within an hour after the session ended, we had 15 questions listed. We'll write a longer list for the session on Monday, April 5th. Seth Speaks by Jane Roberts. Copyrighted material. All rights reserved.
Chapter 20. Questions and Answers.
Session 578, April 5, 1971, 9:30 p.m., Monday. As instructed by Seth in the last session, I had compiled a list of questions for this chapter. It wasn't complete, but, surprisingly, it already ran to 5 typed pages and some 52 items. I contributed a lot of them, but also consulted with Jane. The list included some of the many interesting questions Sue Watkins had asked. We had saved these, along with those raised by ourselves and others in connection with various older sessions. All of the questions, we thought, had a timeless quality. Earlier today, I told Jane that I was afraid the questions weren't very representative of Seth's book, and that to assemble a truly relevant list of them would require an intimate study of each chapter. This we hadn't done, of course, partly because of time limitations, partly because Jane hadn't wanted to be that involved consciously. We were left hoping that, intuitively, the list would be an appropriate one. We sat for the session at 9 o'clock, as we almost always do, but Seth didn't appear with his usual promptness. As the time passed, Jane said she thought she was somewhat uptight because of the questions. She had read them after supper. The session was held in my studio for more privacy. Finally, Jane took off her glasses.
Now, good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
Begin with your famous list of questions.
Well, first I'll read you this paragraph heading the list. Some of these questions may refer to subjects you plan to cover in later chapters. If so, let us know and we'll just pass them by for consideration in this chapter.
I will indeed.
Okay, here's question number one. You said you'd tell us about the third Christ. Also, do we need to know more about the other two personalities belonging to the Christ entity, Christ himself and John the Baptist?
Let the religious questions go for now.
Does that include data on the speakers? I plan to ask several questions about the speakers.
No, just the questions about the world religions and those pertaining to the third Christ and allied subjects.
All right. Question number two. Was the statement given by Jane while speaking for you correct, that there have been millions of speakers, or was this distorted? See the 568th session in chapter 17.
It was not distorted. The speakers are gifted according to their own characters, some having far more abilities than others, but all playing roles in the communication of inner data. In your terms, therefore, some speakers would be much more accomplished than others. For example, there have been a far smaller number of truly prominent speakers than the number given. There have been less than 30 great speakers. Give us time here.
Pause at 9:35. Jane's pace was quite slow.
The Christ entity was one. The Buddha was another. These speakers are as active when they are non-physical as when they are physical. The Christ entity had many reincarnations before the emergence of the Christ personality as known, as did the Buddha. The greatest speakers do not only translate and communicate inner data, but also go much further into these inner realms of reality than others connected with your physical system. They add, then, to the basic inner data. The greatest speakers have not needed the intensive training necessary for most. Their unique combination of characteristics has made this unnecessary. At another level, Emerson was a speaker. A man named Marbundu.
My phonetic interpretation. Do you want to spell that?
M-A-U-B-U-N-D-U, in Africa, 14 BC. The speakers, more than most, are highly active through all aspects of existence, whether physical or non-physical, waking or sleeping, between lives or at other levels of reality. As certain physical data are carried along in the gene structure, so this inner information is codified within whatever psychological structures the speakers may inhabit, but far more readily available than it is to other personalities. It needs often trigger points to release it, however. These can take place in either the waking or dream state, and they serve to open up the reservoirs of knowledge and make past training available. I know that one of your questions has to do with a first speaker.
Yes, number four. Is it possible to name or describe a first speaker?
Now, In greater terms, there was no first speaker. Imagine that you wanted to be 10 places at once, and that you actually sent one portion of yourself to each of these 10 places. Imagine that you could scatter yourself in those 10 directions, and that each of the 10 portions were conscious, alert, and aware. You, being the 10 of you, would be aware of existence in each of the 10 places. It would be impossible to ask which of the 10 arrived first, except to say that all began with the original who decided to visit the 10 locations. So it is with the speakers, who in the same way do not originate in the locations or in the times in which they may appear. Do you have more speaker questions?
Well, that brings me to number 3, which you've already been getting into. What is the original source of the speaker data? Where did it come from and when?
The original source of the speaker data is the inner knowledge of the nature of reality that is within each individual. The speakers are to keep the information alive in physical terms, to see that men do not bury it within and dam it up, to bring it, the information, to the attention of the conscious self. They speak the inner secrets, in other words. In some civilizations, as mentioned earlier in this book, they played a much stronger part, practically speaking. At times, they were consistently, consciously, and egotistically aware of this information. It was then that it was memorized. They realized it was always available at an unconscious level. They imprinted it, however, upon the physical brain through the use of memory. There was always great interaction, however, between inner and outer existence for them, as there is today. Valid information gained in the dream state was memorized in the morning. One speaker heard another's lesson in the dream state. On the other hand, pertinent physical data was also communicated one to another in the dream state, and both states were utilized to a high degree.
Pause.
Do you have any more speaker questions?
Number 5. Were any of the disciples speakers?
I will save that one for the religious chapter. It can be handled more simply.
Number 6. Can speakers work with us while they are between physical lives?
I believe that has been answered.
Yes. See the data at 9:35. I was so busy writing, I didn't realize the question had already been considered.
They can, and do indeed. Both of you are being trained by other speakers who are themselves between lives, this occurring in your dream states. The speakers themselves obviously attain varying degrees of efficiency.
And of course, the above data gives rise to more questions, such as, who is training us? Have we known them in past lives, etc.? Not knowing what to do, I ask no questions.
The large amount of their work is done from a non-physical state, earthly existences being somewhat like very important field trips.
Number 7. Are you going to talk about Seth II in this book?
I am indeed. We will leave that one for now.
Here, there was an exchange between Seth and me in which I didn't have to take notes. Seth said this chapter was intended as a change of pace from the long excerpts included in the book. It was also designed to make the reader think of his own questions. Then I suppose you'll want to handle question number 8 later, too. Are you a medium for Seth II?
Also later.
Number 11. In chapter 17, you said it would require more training on Jane's part before she could deliver a speaker manuscript, and that even then the work involved could take 5 years. What kind of training?
I was speaking specifically of what you would term an ancient speaker's manuscript, and I thought that was what you were referring to.
Yes.
Rupert would not be familiar with a good many of the words and phrases used, even if translation from the original languages was made. There is a difference even in some basic concepts. To maintain any purity of translation, training in different kinds of inner perception would be necessary. Some of these languages dealt with pictures rather than words. In some, the symbols had multidimensional meanings. To deliver such information through Rupert would be an immense task, but it is possible. Oftentimes, words were hidden within pictures, and pictures within words. We speak of manuscripts, yet most of these were not written down. Some were, but at much later dates, and portions exist underground and in caves, in Australia, parts of Africa, and one area of the Pyrenees. Now, I suggest your break.
10:12. Jane's pace had speeded up considerably, as though she had lost some sort of nervousness. She said that now she felt much better about the question and answer format. So did I. The studio had cooled off considerably. Jane said she hadn't been cold in trance, but was now. I told her that question number 9 was next on the list. It had to do with Seth's perceptions while speaking through her, and had been inspired by the ESP class session for February 9, 1971. Excerpts from this are included in the 575th session in Chapter 19. In the meantime, I thought of another speaker query, which I wrote down. Resume at 10:40.
Now, which of the two questions do you want me to answer first?
We'll call this 11A. Wouldn't you say, then, that these sessions are speaker training for Jane and me, raised to a conscious level?
They are indeed. The inner information must be consciously recognized. In your terms, by the time an individual is in his last physical life, all portions of the personality are then familiar with it at the time of death. The personality is not swept willy-nilly back to another earthly existence, as might be the case otherwise. The conscious, physically oriented portions of the self become acquainted with the inner information. To some extent, the reality of thought is consciously perceived as the innovator behind physical matter. Such an individual can then understand the nature of hallucinations at the point of death, and with full conscious awareness, enter into the next plane of existence. The information made conscious is then passed on to others where it can be physically recognized and applied. Now, as to the next question.
Number 9. You told us you were going to elaborate upon what you perceive when you are speaking through Jane to a room full of people. In that ESP class session, you mentioned going into a trance yourself, and the effort required by you to pinpoint us in our time and space.
I perceive people in a room in a far different manner than they perceive themselves. Their various past and future reincarnated personalities, but not their probable selves, are perceived to me. I see the reincarnated aspects, the various manifestations taken in that regard. In your terms, it would be as if you saw a series of quickly moving pictures, all representing various poses of one personality. I must remember, in all communications with those in the room, to limit my remarks and focus to the specific reincarnated present self. I see this composite image myself. It is not registered by Rupert's eyes.
Pause.
Which do not have the multidimensional depth perception necessary. I see the composite image clearly, whether or not I am looking through Rupert's eyes. I use his eyes because they narrow down the focus for me to the one present self of which the individual is aware. Communicating with your system in such a manner demands great diligence and greater discrimination according to the distance of the communicator from the physical system. I am not based within the physical system, for example. The discrimination comes to bear upon the precision needed to enter your reality at the precise time the precise point in time and space upon which you are concentrated. Present and future experience of those in the room are available to me, and as real as their present experience. Therefore, I must remember what they think has already happened, or not yet occurred, for to me it is one. These patterns of activity, however, are also constantly changing. I say, for example, that I am aware of their past and future actions and thoughts, and yet what I am aware of, actually, are ever-shifting and changing patterns, both in the future and in the past.
11 o'clock.
Some of the events that I see connected very clearly with these persons in the future may not, in your physical system, occur. They exist as probabilities, as potentials, actualized in thoughts but not turned into definite physical form. I told you that no events were predetermined. I would have to tune into a future date in your terms and probe it with all of its ramifications in order to ascertain which of the probable actions I saw in your earlier would be actualized in your later. To a large extent, the methods of communication may vary. A personality based within physical reality, between lives, for example, would find entry in many ways easier. The information he would be able to give, however, would also be limited because of his experience. I do have a memory of physical existence, however, and this automatically helps me in translating your mental data into physical form. I do perceive objects, for example. Using Rupert's mechanism is of great help here also. At times, I see the room and the people as he, or rather, his perceptive mechanisms, do. In this case, I translate, or read that data, and use it as you might a computer's. Will that answer your question?
Excellent.
I am ready for the next.
Number 10. Are you going to tell us about some of the ways you contacted Jane before these sessions began?
I mentioned some of that in an earlier chapter. Much of her training as Jane took place in the dream state. There were frequent out-of-body projections in which she attended classes, taught initially by various speakers. The information gained was often brought to conscious levels through the poetry.
Long pause at 11:15.
There was a concentrated training that allowed her to focus inward, an exterior environment that forced her to look inward for answers, and a strong religious structure in which initial growth could take place. That is enough.
A long pause while I scanned the next three questions, 12, 13, and 14.
If this is the reincarnational material, let that go for now.
It was. I skipped down to number 19, a question I almost hadn't bothered to write down. Do you have any interest in perceiving our daily lives when you're not speaking through Jane? Is this possible?
I do not make it a practice to observe. We are connected, however, in our psychological gestalt, and so I am aware of any intense feelings on your part, or strong reactions of any kind. This does not mean that I am necessarily aware of all events within your lives, or that I always break down the feelings I receive from you into specifics.
Pause at 11:25.
I am generally aware, therefore, of your condition. If anything upsets Rupert, he automatically sends me messages about it. I am aware, within the limitations mentioned, of future events in your lives.
Pause.
I am much more concerned with your overall spiritual vitality than I am with what you had for breakfast. I think that will do for that one.
Okay. Well, that was very interesting. I don't know whether to ask for a break or end the session.
I will handle the questions on evolution and fragments, probably together, and suggest they wait for the next session. You may end the session or take a break, as you prefer.
I guess we'd better end it then, sorry to say.
They were good questions, as I knew they would be.
I was kind of concerned about them.
I hope you are relieved now.
I'm very pleased, yes.
My heartiest regards, and a fond good evening.
Well, thank you very much, Seth, and good night. 11:30 p.m. Session 580, April 12, 1971, 9:13 p.m., Monday. Wednesday session, the 579th, was held for a husband and wife who have an acute problem involving one of their children. The family lives in another state and we have never met. We learned later that Seth's material was very helpful. Before the session tonight, I discussed two questions with Jane that I hoped Seth would consider. We also wanted some personal material. The session was held in my studio once again. Good evening, Seth.
Now, do you want to begin with questions or with personal material?
How about a question first?
You give it to me then.
Number 20. If everything exists now or at once, how can it be added to through constant creation or expansion? Or to put it another way, if we are constantly creating, how can all that is exist as complete now?
All that is not done and finished.
Long pause. Jane's pace was alternately fast and slow.
Everything within your three-dimensional system occurs simultaneously. Each action creates other possibilities of itself, or other actions from the infinite energy of the universe, which itself is never still. The answer is that the whole is more than the sum of its parts.
Pause.
All that is simultaneously and unendingly creates itself. Only within your particular frame of reference does there seem to be a contradiction between action that is simultaneous and yet unending. This has to do mainly with the necessary distortions arising from your time concept and the idea of duration. For duration to you presupposes existence continued within a time framework, predisposing to beginnings and endings. Experience existing outside of that reference is not dependent upon duration in your terms. There is no perfect ending, no completed perfection beyond which further existence is impossible or meaningless.
Long pause.
All that is a source of infinite and unending simultaneous action. Everything happens at once, and yet there is no beginning and end to it in your terms, so it is not completed in your terms at any given point.
9:25.
Your idea of development and growth, again, implies a one-line march toward perfection, so it would be difficult for you to imagine the kind of order that pervades. Ultimately, a completed or finished God, or all that is, would end up smothering his creation. For perfection presupposes that point beyond which development is impossible, and creativity at an end. There would be an order in which only predetermination could rule, each part fitting in with a particular order without freedom to change the pattern given it. There is order, but within this order there is freedom, the freedom of creativity. That characteristic of all that is that guarantees its infinite becoming. Now in that infinite becoming, there are states that you would call perfected, but had creativity rested within them, all of experience would be destined to grind to a halt. Yet this great complexity is not unwieldy. It is as simple, in fact, as a seed.
9:32.
All that is inexhaustible. Infinity rests within simultaneous action in a way that you cannot presently understand. Give us a moment.
Long pause.
All that is alive within the least of itself, aware within, for example, the molecule. It endows all of its parts or its creations with its own abilities that then act as inspiration, impetus, guiding lines and principles, by which these parts then seek to further create themselves, their own worlds and systems. This is freely given.
Long pause at 9:37.
These powers and abilities will be used by these creations in various ways. In your own case, mankind is forming his reality through the use of these gifts. He is learning to use them efficiently and well. He uses them to exist. They form the basis of his reality. Within that framework, individually and as a whole, mankind may seem to make errors, to bring ill health, death, or desolation upon himself, but he is still using those abilities to create a world. Through observing his creations, he learns how to use these abilities better. He checks on his inner progress by seeing the physical materialization of his work. The work, the reality, is still a creative achievement, although it may portray a tragedy or unspeakable terror in your terms at any given time.
Well, you're leading into the next question then. Number 21. How do you account for the pain and suffering in the world? Many people have asked us this question. 9:43.
I am indeed. A great painting of a battle scene, for example, may show the ability of the artist as he projects in all its appalling drama the inhuman and yet all too human conditions of war. The artist is using his abilities. In the same way, man is using his abilities, and they are apparent when he creates a real war. The artist who paints such a scene may do so for several reasons. Because he hopes through portraying such inhumanity to awaken people to its consequences, to make them quail and change their ways. Because he is himself in such a state of disease and turmoil that he directs his abilities in that particular manner. Or because he is fascinated with the problem of destruction and creativity, and of using creativity to portray destruction. In your wars, you are using creativity to create destruction, but you cannot help being creative.
9:48.
Illness and suffering are not thrust upon you by God, or by all that is, or by an outside agency. They are byproducts of the learning process, created by you, in themselves quite neutral. On the other hand, your existence itself, the reality and nature of your planet, the whole existence in which you have these experiences, are also created by you, using the abilities of which I have spoken. Illness and suffering are the results of the misdirection of creative energy. They are a part of the creative force, however. They do not come from a different source than, say, health and vitality. Suffering is not good for the soul unless it teaches you how to stop suffering. That is its purpose. Within your particular plane of activity, and speaking practically, no one fully or completely can use all the energy available to them, or completely materialize the inner sensed identity that is multidimensional. This inner identity is the blueprint, however, against which you judge ultimately your physical actions. You strive to express as best you can the entire potential that is within you.
9:58.
Within that framework, it is possible to have sane and healthy minds within healthy bodies, to have a sane planet. The release and use of creative energy expended simply to maintain your planet and your existence is impossible to conceive of. The great amount of energy available to you gives you great leeway in its use. I have mentioned before that everyone within your system is learning to handle this creative energy, and since you are still in the process of doing so, you will often misdirect it. The resulting snarl in activities automatically brings you back to inner questions. Now you may take your break.
10:02. This was the end of the material on Seth's book. The balance of the session was taken up with personal material. End at 11:06 p.m. Session 581, April 14, 1971, 9:16 p.m., Wednesday. On Thursday night, April 8th, Jane and I were visited by three women from Rochester, New York. They were very interested in talking about Jane's book, The Seth Material. They also gave me several questions for Seth to answer in his own book, if he chose to do so. Jane and I went over them briefly before the session.
Good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
Now, suppose we begin with the first question you were discussing.
By M.H., her query was based on a theory that, as it happened, I'd heard of also. A group of scientists has postulated the existence of a class of subatomic particles called tachyons, or metaparticles, that always travel faster than the speed of light. According to the theory of relativity, no particle can be accelerated to the speed of light because its mass would become infinitely large as it approached light's velocity. But this barrier is bypassed by stating that the particles in question have an imaginary proper mass, not rest mass, that is never less than the speed of light. M.H. asked then, are these faster-than-light particles the same as, or like, the electromagnetic energy, or EE units, Seth discusses in the appendix of the Seth material?
I told you some time ago that there were many gradations of matter or form that you did not perceive. In your terms, many of these particles making up such constructions do move faster than the speed of your light. Your light, again, represents only a portion of an even larger spectrum than that of which you know. And when your scientists study its properties, they can only investigate light as it intrudes into the three-dimensional system. The same, of course, applies to a study of the structure of matter or form. There are indeed universes composed of such faster-than-light particles. Some of these, in your terms, share the same space as your own universe. You simply would not perceive such particles as mass. When these particles are slowed down sufficiently, you do experience them as matter. Some of these particles drastically alter their velocity, appearing sometimes at your slower rate, usually in cyclic fashion. The inner vortex of some particles has a much greater velocity than the orbiting portions. EE units are formed spontaneously from the electromagnetic reality of feelings emitted from each consciousness, as, for example, breath automatically goes out from the physical body.
9:27.
EE units are, then, emanations from consciousness. The intensity of the thought or emotion determines the characteristics of the units themselves. As certain ranges are reached, they are propelled into physical actualization. Whether or not this occurs in your terms, they will exist as small matter particles, as, say, latent matter or pseudo-matter. Some of these will fall into the faster-than-light groupings and have a perceivable vitality within that framework. These faster-than-light particles, of course, exist in their own kind of form, then. There are many ranges and great varieties of such units, all existing beyond your perceivable reach. To lump them together in such a way, however, is misleading, for within all of this there is great order.
9:33.
You are not utterly unaware of the existence of some of these units, though you do not experience them as mass. You interpret some of them as events, dream events, so-called hallucinations, and sometimes certain ranges of these units are interpreted by you as movement through time. All of them cast certain atmospheric conditions or reflections that color physical events as you know them. Some of your own feelings are propelled into a reality within such systems, adopting within that framework their own mass and form. In the creation and maintenance of your normal reality, you focus your daily waking consciousness so that it becomes effective within the ranges necessary. Ideas and feelings that you want made physical carry within them the mechanisms that will put them in the proper range, well within the electromagnetic field necessary for physical development.
Pause at 9:40.
Your consciousness, however, is equipped to create realities in other fields as well. Now, in certain dreams and out-of-body experiences, your own consciousness moves faster than the speed of light, and under such conditions you are able to perceive some of these other forms of mass or matter. The EE units are quite simply incipient forms of reality. Seeds automatically given birth, suited for different environments, some appearing within the physical framework, and some not conforming at all to its prerequisites. Now, some systems of reality are bounded within centers of faster-than-light particles. These begin to slow down at a rhythmic rate toward the peripheries, in your terms, over great distances, until actually the outside, slower particles to some extent, imprison the center masses, even though they move much more quickly, but within a confined area.
9:45.
The behaviors of such units, as you can now see, form the particular camouflage within any given system, while the peripheral activities effectively set up inner identities and outer boundaries. These are all variations, generally speaking, and very simply put, on matter as you think of it. The same applies to negative or antimatter, however, which you do not perceive in any case. But the gradations of activity within such systems are as diverse. Basically, however, no system is closed. Energy flows freely from one to another, or rather, permeates each. It is only the camouflage structure that gives the impression of closed systems, and the law of inertia does not apply. It appears to be a reality only within your own framework and because of your limited focus. Now, the duration and relative stability of such matter within other systems varies considerably, with intensity determining the strength of all such manifestations. The invisible EE units form your physical matter and represent the essential and basic units from which any physical particle appears.
9:52.
It will not be physically perceived. You see only its results. Since consciousness can travel faster than the speed of light, then when it is not imprisoned by the slower particles of the body, it can become aware of some of these other realities. Without training, however, it will not know how to interpret what it sees. The physical brain is the mechanism by which thought or emotion is automatically formed into EE units of the proper range and intensity to be used by the physical organism. Now you may take your break.
9:56. Jane's delivery had alternated between slower and faster states, but her trance had been deep. When I told her the material was a great answer to the question, she said, "I just know I was way away." A note pertaining to faster-than-light effects. On the Sunday following this session, a leading New York City newspaper reported that astronomers have observed two components of a quasar flying apart at apparently 10 times the speed of light. This is an astonishing discovery, one that is impossible according to the laws of physics. Quasars, quasi-stellar radio sources, are extraordinarily powerful sources of light and radio waves. Most scientists believe they exist on the edge of our observable universe. If this is so, They are so far away that their energy has taken billions of years to reach us. Resume at 10:20.
These EE units, then, are the psychic building blocks of matter. Now, you may go on to another question.
Number 23. Are you in contact with or speaking through any other humans as you are with Jane?
No. As mentioned earlier in this book, I do contact some in other levels of reality, however.
Seth paused, so I asked him a second question from M.H. Is experiencing inner vibrational touch akin to reading an aura? Inner vibrational touch is one of our inner senses. To paraphrase, using this sense, an observer standing on a typical street would feel the experience of being anything he chose within his field of notice, people, trees, insects, blades of grass. He would retain his own consciousness and would perceive sensations somewhat in the way we now feel heat and cold. This sense is like empathy, but much more vital.
No. Inner vibrational touch is a much more personal experience, more like becoming a part of that which you perceive, rather than, for example, a reading of an aura.
Ready for the next question?
I am waiting.
Number 24. Does Jane ever prevent your coming through when you want to?
On several occasions, I have communicated my willingness in particular circumstances. I knew more about those circumstances than Rupert. Some of these occasions occurred fairly early in our sessions, when Rupert was worried about spontaneous trances, so after making my presence known to him, I acquiesced to his decision at the time. On a few occasions, certain conditions have been poor. Usually, Rupert reacted to these adversely at his end. That is, the interference was such that it would bother his situation rather than mine.
Many sessions ago, Seth told us he had a dog fragment personality still here on Earth. He wouldn't tell us where it was, though. Number 25. Do you have any physical fragments of any kind still here on Earth?
I do not now. My dog is gone.
Number 26. Are animals fragments of human beings? Smile.
It is a good question, and you had better give me a moment to explain it clearly.
10:30.
In one manner of speaking, you are fragments of your entities. Yet you consider yourselves quite independent, and not thrust off second-handed selves. So dogs and other animals are not simply the manifestation of stray psychic energy on the part of human beings. Animals have varying degrees of self-consciousness, as indeed people do. The consciousness that is within them is as valid and eternal as your own, however. There is nothing to prevent a personality from investing a portion of his own energy into an animal form. This is not transmigration of souls. It does not mean that a man can be reincarnated in an animal. It does mean that personalities can send a portion of their energy into various kinds of form.
10:35.
Perhaps reincarnations are over for a given individual, for example, yet within him is still some sense of yearning for the natural earth with which he has so often been involved. So, he may project a fragment of his consciousness in such a way into an animal form. When this is done, the earth is then experienced in the way natural for the form. A man is not an animal then, nor does he invade, say, the body of one. He simply adds some of his energy to that present in the animal, mixing this vitality with the animal's own. This does not mean that all animals are fragments in this manner, however. Animals, as any pet owner knows, have their own personalities and characteristics, and individual ways of perceiving the reality available to them. Some gobble experience, Their consciousness can be immeasurably quickened by contact with friendly humans, and emotional involvement with life is strongly developed. The mechanics of consciousness remain the same. They do not change for animals or men. Therefore, there are no limitations set upon the development of any individual consciousness or growth of any identity. Consciousness, both in the body and without, finds its own range, its own level. A dog, then, is not limited to being a dog in other existences. A certain level, again, of consciousness is necessary, a certain kind of knowledge, a certain understanding of energy organization before an identity can manipulate a complicated physical organism.
10:45.
As you know, consciousness has a great tendency to maintain individuality, and yet to join in gestalts at the same time. An animal consciousness after death may form such a gestalt with other such consciousnesses, in which abilities are pooled, and the combined cooperation makes possible, for example, a change of species. In these and other cases, however, the innate individuality is not lost, but remains indelibly imprinted. Consciousness must by its nature change, and so identities must also change, not one blotting out the other, but building upon it, while each succeeding step is maintained and not discarded, you see. In such interrelationships, the steps or identities are each immeasurably enriched by the added perception of the others. As mentioned earlier, thoughts containing their own electromagnetic reality have form, whether or not you perceive it. With each thought, then, you send out from yourself shapes and images that can be quite legitimate realities to those within the system of reality into which they are propelled. In the same way, personalities from other systems can send energy to yours. Since such events do not originate within your system, you do not understand their import. Now you may take your break.
10:54. Jane's trance had again been good, her delivery variable. This was the end of the material on Seth's book for the evening. The rest of the session was taken up with matters involving ourselves and others. End at 11:20 p.m. Session 582, April 19, 1971, 9:20 p.m., Monday. Before the session, we read over a letter Jane had received on March 16, 1971, from Mrs. R. Her son had disappeared on June 28, 1970. Jane had written her on April 4th, promising some information soon.
Good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
Now, begin with your program. What do you have for me first?
How about answering the letter from Mrs. R. first, as Seth Jane reached out for the letter?
Hand it to me. Now, give us a moment.
Eyes closed, Jane leaned back in her rocker with a folded letter in her right hand.
The boy has been in several locations, with one stop, a brief one, in a hospital. He seemed to have some difficulty with a lung, or his lungs. I believe he visited Detroit.
Pause.
Also, the state of Florida, near a small town beginning with a P, but a long enough name. California was in his mind strongly also. 36.
Pause.
He had one job in what seems to be a factory location in a rather dark environment, with rows of what I assume to be machinery and large windows, treated so that the sunlight did not shine through brightly. Either this or the place was half below ground level. The name George connected with him, a friend perhaps. Also, he sent a telegram, I believe, either to someone, or he will send one to his mother. There is a connection with two young women.
Long pause.
The mother will hear from him, however. That is all I have for now.
The above data was delivered at a crisp pace. We have no way of knowing how long Seth's reply to a query like Mrs. R's will be. Whatever the length, 1, 5, or 10 pages, we send a copy of it to the writer as soon as I get the session typed up. We ask for a reply to see if it's possible to check the material. In this case, we didn't hear from Mrs. R.
We will try.